So I'll talk about conserved momenta of ferromagnetic solitons. It turns out that this subject is pretty old. People have been thinking about this in the 70s. And at that time, they actually had a pretty good idea of what conserved momentum of a ferromagnetic soliton is. And then in the 80s, people started using field theory to describe ferromagnets, and it went downhill. And so people were using actually their own recipe, it turns out. So I'll show how to straighten it up. So you probably don't work with ferromagnets much around here, right? So I'll tell you how weird they are first. So let's imagine we have, well, first of all, the dynamics of spins is pretty weird, right? So if you have a spin and you place it in the magnetic field so that the magnetic field points up, and so it's pushing the spin to point toward the direction of the field, right? So if it, you push it this way, but it's not going to move that way, instead it's going to process. Right? So it works a lot like a gyroscope. If you've ever played with a gyroscope, it's a pretty non-intuitive thing, right? So you push it, but it goes in an orthogonal direction. So all this weirdness will actually come out in this talk, and it'll turn out to be interesting, I hope. So I'm going to consider a very simple model of a ferromagnet. So the magnetization will be depicted as a field of unit length, right? So M is equal to 1. It's a nonlinear sigma model, but the dynamical term is not what you usually see. And it's basically the direction of magnetization, right? So at low temperatures, longitudinal magnetization fluctuations are absent, so you can approximate it by a field of constant length. And you can write down the potential energy as something like, so let's do it in one dimension for simplicity. You will have a tendency for spins to align. And if they misalign with each other, then you'll have a penalty. And so you'll have something like the spatial derivative squared as your exchange term. So then a state with any direction in space will be fine. So there's a spontaneously broken symmetry. And then we can add to that an easy axis anisotropy so that we can have domain walls, right? In order to have domain walls, you need to have domains. And so let's say we have a term that prefers that the spins point in the z direction like this, right? So there are two ground states, m equal to plus and minus z. And of course, if there are two ground states, you... No, it's m cross z squared, right? So if m is along the z direction, then there is no penalty, and if it deviates from that, then it, the energy rises. You can of course write it minus k over 2 m dot z squared. It doesn't really matter. The sign will change. So you can imagine having something like this, where magnetization points to the left on the left-hand side and to the right on the right-hand side. So this would be a topological defect, which cannot be erased by doing something locally. So in between, the spins will interpolate. And so this is a field with three components, right? So it's mx, my, and mz. And you can tell right away that the soliton will have two soft modes associated with the spontaneous breaking of the translational symmetry here, right? So it's somewhere. So if we call this direction z, then the coordinate of the soliton, its location, capital Z, would be a soft mode. You can move it without changing energy. And the second coordinate would be the orientation of the spins on the domain wall, right? So they could interpolate like this, or they could interpolate like that, or they could point toward you or away from you. So there's the azimuthal angle to do that, right? And so if you're interested in writing out an explicit solution for the soliton, you can just minimize the energy, and you can express it in spherical angles. Sine theta, cosine theta. Cosine phi would be the x component. Sine theta, sine phi, the y component. Cosine theta, the z component. And then cosine theta would be plus or minus the hyperbolic tangent, z minus capital Z divided by lambda, where lambda is set by the coupling constants, it would be the square root of A divided by K. And phi of Z would be just a constant in space. And so the spins will lie in the same plane, right? So they will interpolate either in this plane, so in any plane in, that is perpendicular to the equator. Right. So it's an object with 2 degrees of freedom, Z and phi. If you examine it at low energies, if you hit it hard, then of course you can change the width, you can create ripples on it, but we're not interested in that. We're interested in applying a small perturbation and seeing what happens to it. And so the response will be in these two channels. So you can push the domain wall, you can twist it, apply torque to it. And the question is, how will these coordinates react, right? So you can apply a force, you can apply a torque. And the question is, what will happen then? And the answer will be a bit strange, and you can formulate it in the following way. So that, you know, let's make an analogy with a bead on a string, right? A bead on a string has two coordinates too. It can move along the string, and you can also rotate it. If you push a bead, it will accelerate, and if you twist it, it's gonna spin up, right? Well, if you push this domain wall, it's gonna spin up, it's gonna rotate. And if you twist it, it's going to move. So it doesn't work in the same way as the everyday objects do, and so here's why. To understand why that happens, you can ask a different question. And instead of asking what happens if you apply a force or apply a torque, you can ask, what are the linear and angular momenta of the soliton? And the answers are a bit surprising. So the angular momentum J turns out to be its coordinate. So it's some constant times the coordinate. So you can see why that happens. Right? The angular momentum of this ferromagnet comes from spins. And so in this configuration right now, if it's right in the middle of the wire, then you have equal numbers of spins pointing in the plus Z and the minus Z directions. So the angular momentum in that case is zero. If you shift it to the right, then there'll be more spins pointing left. And so the angular momentum will decrease in proportion to the shift. And so this constant C would be minus 2 times J, where J is the spin density. Okay. And so once you figure this out, you can use Newton's second law, essentially that says, torque gives you a change in the angular momentum, and that's minus twice J times dz dt. So you twist it, and it moves. So I'll tell you later how you can twist it. But for now, let me tell you what happens if you push it. If you push it, it rotates. And that's not actually obvious initially, but then you can reason in the following way. So what we've done here is we've found that the angle phi and the coordinate z, they kind of form a canonical pair, right? So it's like phi and momentum conjugate to phi. So this configuration space is actually a phase space. And there are all kinds of interesting consequences because of that. So for instance, you cannot measure momentum and coordinate simultaneously. So there'll be an uncertainty relation for phi and z. So delta phi times 2j delta z would be no less than h bar over 2, and so you can figure out in simple models what the uncertainty will be. It turns out that in a spin chain, this would be greater than a over 4s or something like that. S is the spin length, and a is the lattice constant. So this comes from just quantum fluctuations of spins, right? When spins are non-collinear, they'll fluctuate, so you won't be able to measure both of these quantities simultaneously. So now you can turn this around and say, well, phi z is a phase space, so phi will be some sort of a momentum conjugate to z, and then you can represent it like that. And so it means that pz would be proportional to phi with the same proportionality coefficient. And so the linear momentum of the soliton is going to be the azimuthal angle. Not the velocity, the azimuthal angle. So if you push it, you're going to change linear momentum, and that gives you a precession. Rather strange. But it becomes less strange if you think about how you push a domain wall. So what do you think? How do you push a domain wall? You apply a magnetic field. Right, so if you go there, if you apply a magnetic field in the positive z direction, then this part of magnetization will have a low energy, and this part of magnetization will have a higher energy. So if you shift this domain wall to the right, the energy will increase because you will have more spins with the wrong orientation, and it will increase in proportion to the displacement. So there's a force proportional to the field. But if you place a magnetic chain in a magnetic field, then spins tend to precess in the magnetic field, right? If they were free spins, they would rotate immediately. And when you put them in a chain like that, they would still precess about the direction of the field to which they're perpendicular. You can work out the mathematics, and it'll turn out that the domain wall will precess with the same frequency as the free spin. The Larmor frequency, nothing else. Just the gyromagnetic ratio times the magnetic field. But it seems like this is a pretty fundamental thing, because you know I don't have to know all the details about the domain wall. I just need to know that it's a topological defect that interpolates between left and right. Other than that, the frequency is universal. Okay. Max. Yeah. You mean it's compact? That's yeah. That's pretty strange, right? So we'll get back to that. Duncan Haldane thought about this, and I'll refer to that work. And so this angular nature will come up again. Okay, so this is the informal part. So now one can try and make sense of this and actually derive it somehow. And one can take to field theory of a ferromagnet to derive these quantities, right? So for instance, if you want momentum, you need to know the momentum density, so you can introduce some tensor energy momentum. Right, so you introduce something like T mu nu, which would be the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to that multiplied with partial mu. And subtract the Lagrangian, right? So T01 or T10 component. So momentum density would be linear momentum density would be T10, which is minus T10 as you raise the index. Right? So what you need to figure out is the derivative with respect to time. Right? And then multiply by the spatial derivative. And you'll have your momentum density. So all we need to know is the Lagrangian of a ferromagnet. And the Lagrangian of a ferromagnet would be, so should I use this board or are there more here? I mean, if this one goes up, it'll slide under that one. So maybe.
You can use the right one.
Yeah, okay. So there's still space here. That's fine, right? Okay, so we already know what the potential energy is, right? So we need to add the kinetic energy to this piece, something that contains a time derivative. And that piece is not typical for our familiar matter. So it'll be something like this. It'll be a vector potential piece. And so you subtract whatever the potential energy density is. and you integrate over x. Oh, sorry, you don't integrate. This is the Lagrangian density. Right. So that's that. Where the vector potential is defined on the sphere, so if you take the curl, then this would be minus spin density times the vector itself. So this is a description of a spin which kind of says the following. So if you have a spin and you picture it as a particle moving on a sphere, it behaves like a charged particle in the magnetic field produced by a monopole. So this is B equal to some minus JM. So that actually points the other way, but let me draw it correctly. Right, so let's say the equilibrium position is at the north pole. That's where the potential energy is minimum, but the particle happens to be over here. Right? So it's being pushed in that direction. So there's a force pushing it that way, right? So let's say the restoring force. And instead we know that it will be precessing, right? It won't be moving that way, it'll be precessing, right, like that. So it should be moving in the perpendicular direction. So in order to achieve that, you add something that resembles the Lorentz force, right? So E V cross B, and you add no mass term. So if you do that, then the velocity will have to be perpendicular to the force, right? So V, so force is in this direction, and the velocity would have to be, let's say, out of the plane, coming this way, so that V cross B will give you a Lorentz force pushing that way, right? And so you will have equilibrium of these two forces, and that's how the spin processes. So you can pretend that this is a charged particle on a little sphere in the field of a magnetic monopole, and this is your dynamics, right? And you know how to describe a particle moving in the field of a monopole, or sorry, just in the magnetic field, right? So it's going to have a term that's EV dot A, so that's precisely what I have here in the Lagrangian. So you write this term for every spin, and then you integrate over all the spins. And so this tells you what the curl of this A is, and it's like that. You may have seen this in a specific gauge. If you take, right, so for a particular point, let's say this point, you can introduce a reference frame. This would be the unit vector in the direction of the radius. This would be the unit vector in the direction of angle theta, so that's angle theta, or in the direction south. And then there will be an east-pointing vector, which would be E phi, right? And so if you write A in terms of these angles, AR times ER plus A theta times E theta plus A phi times E phi, and the typical gauge that people use is AR is zero, A theta is zero, and A phi would be J times cosine theta minus one divided by sine theta. So I think you've seen something like that. And if you add it to the action, to the Lagrangian, this would be something like J cosine theta minus one times phi dot. Right, the velocity along the phi direction is sine theta phi dot, and so the sine theta cancels this sine theta, and you've got this. So that's a more familiar expression that those of you who work with magnetism have probably seen many times. Right. Okay, so the one potential problem that you can see here is that the Lagrangian here is gauge dependent, and whatever expression you might get for momentum might be gauge dependent. And it will be. So let's just press on and calculate what this quantity is, right? So tensor T10 would be, you differentiate with respect to M dot, you replace it with M prime, and so it's going to be just minus A of M dotted with M prime. And then, sorry, plus, and then momentum density would be T10, both upper components, so you just change the sign, raising the spatial index, and you've got this expression. Okay. So let's calculate the momentum of this soliton. So Pz would be a spatial integral of that, minus in front, A of M dot M prime, and then integrated over Z. So you can combine M prime and dz, and you will get an integral of the following sort. Right. So this is our sphere. Suppose I have a monopole, I have a soliton in which I start somewhere here at minus infinity, I walk around the sphere, and then I come back. Right, so this is the path of the soliton. So I start in this direction, and then after wandering around, I come back to the exact same point. This is a non-topological soliton. You can deform it back to the vacuum. So in this case, this expression is very nice because it's a line integral. Right, so in this case, it's a closed loop integral. And so it's equal to the flux going through this contour. And this flux is actually very easy to calculate. This would be the solid angle times the spin density. Right. So if you have this prescription, then the momentum turns out to be just some quantity with a nice geometrical interpretation. Except there is one problem. You can imagine starting with a magnetic texture that deviates very little from the vacuum, right? So you start at the North Pole, you just go away a little bit, and then you come back, right? So it looks like this. So this soliton will have a small momentum, and then you can grow it, and the momentum will increase, right? And it will keep increasing as you do this, and eventually this will be big. But at some point, you will have to ask whether I should use the, suppose I have a soliton that goes around the sphere like this. Should I use the upper portion to calculate the solid angle or the lower portion to calculate the solid angle? And the answers will differ by 4 pi, right? So it will turn out that the momentum is only defined modulo 4 pi, 4 pi times j. So this is the question that was asked by Duncan Haldane. Why is there this? Well, as you probably remember, there's also a Dirac string attached to the sphere, and so actually you shouldn't be, the flux will be the same through this portion and through that portion because of the Dirac string. So in principle, that does not affect, it would seem to get rid of this problem. But then you can say, well, suppose I move my soliton without changing its area. And as I come to the Dirac string, at some point I will cross the Dirac string, and then the momentum will increase again by the same quantity, 4 pi times j. So it seems to be a problem, right? That the momentum is not well defined. So here's how Duncan resolved it. He said, well, let's remember that this is a ferromagnet. Although we wrote down a classical field theory of a ferromagnet, it comes from quantum spins that live on a discrete lattice. And if spins live on a discrete lattice, then you can't have any translation that you like. You only have discrete translations. So you don't have a momentum operator, but you have a displacement operator by one lattice constant. Right, and that would be the exponential of minus I bz a divided by h bar. So this operator will have an uncertainty or an an ambiguity equal to 4 pi j. And so that would be this factor, the exponential of minus I 4 pi j a divided by h bar. So it's a phase factor, right? If you now recall that the spin density is h bar s divided by a, then the h bar will cancel out, the lattice constant will cancel out, and you'll get the exponential of minus I 4 pi times the spin length. And this is 2 pi times an integer, so this is 1. So somehow it turns out that this field theory, although it's a classical field theory in the continuum, it still remembers that it comes from a discrete ferromagnetic chain. Next.
So I guess you're considering an insulating ferromagnet that's fully polarized. Does this mean that there exists no insulating ferromagnet that's not fully polarized?
I mean, they can be, they're not necessarily fully polarized, but then it becomes a pain to take into account these fluctuations, right? So any specific configuration will have no problem. If you are talking about an averaged configuration, then that's probably not a legitimate thing to do, because you're considering a reduced spin as a result of thermal fluctuations, for instance, right?
Well,
quantum fluctuations. So if you consider any exact configuration of a ferromagnet, you're talking about working with some coarse grained spins, some coarse grained magnetization vector, right? And so that's the problem of that description. So if one doesn't make the approximation, then everything is fine. Yeah, but it tells you that this is not a complete theory, that there's something that you have to take care of, right? You can't just assume that S is three and a quarter, right? So, okay. Is there an eraser here? Yeah. So this is what Duncan wrote in 1986. But things actually get worse if you consider a soliton that's topological, right? So you just go back to the equation that we've derived. And so if it's a topological soliton, then you can see that the situation is pretty interesting. So you have a soliton that begins at the North Pole, and then it ends at the South Pole, right? This is a domain wall. And so for this domain wall, Pz would be minus the integral of A of m dot dm. And it's not a closed loop anymore. So you can't even define something that's invariant. So it'll change under gauge transformations, right? So it cannot be a conserved quantity. It's not even a physical quantity anymore, okay? So people have used various tricks to resolve this. And one trick would be to say, fine, the momentum of one soliton is not defined, but if you compare the momenta of two solitons, the difference is well defined, right? So what you do then is you take this soliton and another one, and you take the difference, P2z minus P1z. And okay, if you look at this, it looks like the difference is the area of this curve, and that's a gauge invariant quantity. But if you literally follow this recipe, right? If you use the gauge that we had, this is supposed to be minus j cosine theta minus 1 d phi. And you calculate the momentum of this soliton. Both solitons have their phi equal to a constant, right? So d phi is 0 in this case, and d phi is 0 in that case. You get zero momenta for both solitons. You don't get the answer you want. So various tricks can be used, but it basically amounts to trying and getting an answer that you want rather than acting by honest means.
Is it special because you chose to add this soliton
Yeah, if you turn the string this way, like this, for instance, then there is no problem. But then there will be a problem when you calculate other momenta, like the angular momentum. So it turns out that if you calculate the linear and angular momentum using the same gauge, at least one answer will be wrong. Okay, so in this gauge where the string comes from the south, you will get the right answer for the angular momentum, but you will get the wrong answers for the wrong answer for linear momentum. If you shift the string, neither might be right. So one needs to do something else here and not think in these terms. So here's how it can be resolved. Let's describe our soliton not in terms of a field, but as a particle with some collective coordinates. Right? So it could be coordinates z and phi, but it can be other coordinates like the width of the soliton, the presence of a wrinkle here, you know, a twist there. Just imagine some coordinates that will describe it. Right? So we're switching from m of r and t to a new description that involves some collective coordinates that depend on time. So the magnetization will depend on time through the dependence of those coordinates on time. For instance, it might be moving, right? So z is changing in time, and therefore m will be changing in time, or phi is changing in time, or something. The width is changing. Right? So you can translate these equations from that language to this language. And so your Lagrangian will look like this. So not the density, now the full Lagrangian, right? So the first term is a dot m dot, and then there will be some potential energy. Potential energy you can just describe in terms of these new coordinates translated like that. But this term you can describe as follows. Since the dependence on time comes through the dependencies of the collective coordinates on time, this would be dz a of m dot dm dq. And let's introduce numbers for these coordinates, and you'll multiply it by qi dot. And then you subtract u of whatever collective coordinates you have. So if you examine this expression, and you just box this thing, and you call it aq, or ai, what does it look like? Looks like a vector potential coupling to a velocity, right? So we've got AI QI dot minus potential energy. So this is like a charged particle in a magnetic field. The gauge potentials are given by this expression, whatever it is. It's a charged particle in the magnetic field moving in the potential energy landscape. And so we can use some insights from what we know about the motion of charged particles in magnetic fields to understand why we are having a problem here. All right, so let me write down something more familiar. You have a particle with kinetic energy coupling to the gauge field. And maybe some potential energy. Right, it's a particle in the magnetic field, and you can define a canonical momentum in this case, which would be dl divided by dr dot, and that would be mr dot plus e times a. There's also something people call the kinetic momentum pi, which is just the usual mv. So So let me ask you the following question. Suppose you have a uniform magnetic field. Your system is translationally invariant. There are no other forces. Which of these quantities is conserved? Canonical or kinetic momentum? Well, the answer is neither. This one cannot be conserved because it's not physical, right? It's gauge dependent. So this is complete garbage. You can change it however you like, right? And A is not a uniform thing, so it's X dependent. This is not conserved either, right? Because if you have a magnetic field on, your particle is making circles. So what is the conserved momentum? Well, there's the third kind of momentum, which is known as the magnetic translation generator, right? So let's call it P capital. And its nature is as follows. So if U doesn't depend on position, then you have physically a symmetry in the system, which is translations, right? But the problem is that your gauge potential is dependent on the coordinates. So for instance, you can have a gauge in which it's like this, right? If the field is along the z direction, right? So it's explicitly non-translationally invariant. So if you make a shift, this thing will change, but it will describe the same translationally invariant magnetic field. So you can make a gauge transformation to undo the change to the vector potential. So the generator of symmetries here is not simply a translation, which would give you this as the generator, but it's a combination of a translation and a gauge transformation. And so what you have to do is you have to take this generator and then subtract something that comes from unrolling back the change in the vector potential, and that would be this. So you'll remove this piece, but you will also add a piece that looks like this, R cross B. Okay, and so if you substitute this, it'll be MR dot minus ER cross B. So this is known as the generator of magnetic translations, and it's well known in the quantum hole business. What does this conservation quantity, the conservation of this quantity correspond to? Well, it's very simple, right? You have a particle moving in a circle in the magnetic field. So its position is changing, its velocity is changing, but a certain combination of the position and velocity is not changing, right? And that certain combination is written here. You can just rewrite it as R0 minus R0 E or E times this cross B. And this R0 would be the guiding center or center of the cyclotron orbit. So the center of the cyclotron orbit is not going anywhere. Right? That's the conserved quantity. The X and Y components of that are conserved. And so that's a very trivial conservation law then. Right? So, in fact, one doesn't need to know anything about gauge transformations. One can derive it in a much simpler way. One can say, well, what are the equations of motion of a charge in a magnetic field? So it's MR double dot equals the sum of forces, right? So there's a gradient of potential energy, and there is a Lorentz force, ER dot cross B. So if you treat this not as a force, but as a kinematic effect, just like we do this term, right? We never call this a force. It's on the left-hand side. So if we pull this to the left-hand side, we'll have MR double dot minus ER dot cross B equals the gradient of potential energy with a minus sign. And if this thing is zero, that is, we have a translationally invariant situation, this is zero, and so the quantity that is its integral would be this, MR dot minus ER cross B. So this would be conserved. Right? And so that's the simplest way to derive what magnetic translation generator is. That's it. Okay. So there we go. This is how we do it with charged particles in the magnetic field. So the analogy between charged particles and magnetic solitons tells you how to fix the problem for magnetic solitons. So any questions? So far, so good. So let me bring out this analogy a little bit further. The definition of momentum that you obtain from Noether's theorem, in this case, turns out to be just the canonical momentum. Right? So this Pz turns out to be simply the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to z dot, and that turns out to be in this language, it just turns out to be Az, the vector potential corresponding to that. There is no mass term, so we don't have so this part is simply not present. Mass is zero, so our canonical momentum is simply the vector potential, but we know that this is not a physical quantity anyway. And so we just use the same reasoning. One can either reason through the Noether's theorem, or you can just use the equations of motion of a particle, sorry, of a magnetic soliton, and obtain the following. So if you have a collective coordinate qi, then its equations of motion basically can be obtained from this Lagrangian, and you can easily figure out what these equations will be. So it's minus du dqi, that's the conservative force acting on this coordinate, plus something, some tensor fij times qj dot is equal to zero, where the tensor is basically the curl of the vector potential. It's daj dqi minus dai dqj. Right, so it's the magnetic field pretty much filled by this soliton. And if we have, right, so in this derivation, I assume that B doesn't depend on position, because otherwise I would have to take its derivative with respect to time also, but there is none. So uniformity of B is necessary. So likewise here, suppose I have a symmetry such that our potential energy is independent of some coordinate QA, and the corresponding, or neither of the curls of the vector potential depend on that. So this is a physical quantity. This is not gauge dependent. And therefore, this is a physical statement, right? So your system is translationally invariant for some coordinate. So if you say that, then you can just use the equation of motion to obtain the conserved quantity, which would be so actually, let me add here the familiar term so that I keep track of what looks like a momentum. So momentum usually comes from this. So I will then write something like this. So it's mq double dot for this coordinate would be equal to minus du dqa and plus fa I q dot I. So that's the Lorentz force. I take the Lorentz force to the left and I have mq double dot a minus fa I q dot I equals the conservative force. So since this is zero, I can just integrate this thing, and the corresponding conserved quantity would be mq double dot a minus the time integral of fai q dot I dt. Right. And so this quantity is conserved. So this I will transform a little bit, and I combine qi dot with dt, and so this would be minus fai dqi. Right. And so that's how my momentum is defined. The mass at the end of the day I will set to zero because magnetic solitons don't have a mass. And so that's my conserved momentum. Right. So there's one little thing that I have to do here. And I have to make sure that this quantity, which is defined as an integral in this space of collective coordinates, does not depend on the path, right? Because in principle, there's no guarantee that if I take this path in that collective coordinate space, you'll get the same answer if you take that path. So I need to make sure that this quantity is well defined. And so it means that if I take a closed loop integral, this has to be zero, right? And so that guarantees that if for any closed loop this is zero, then it will not depend on the particular trajectory, right? And that's equivalent to taking, to ensuring that there is zero curl for this vector. All right, so think of this as a vector with component I, forget about A, and then this is what you require in order for the line integral to be zero. And if I remember that this is anti-symmetric, then these two terms, if I switch the indices J and I, this is the beginning of the, right, so this is zero. I want this to be zero. And so this is the beginning of which identity this is, I keep forgetting. Yuan, you remember that. Yeah, exactly. So if you add here df ij dqa, right, this would be zero. So you have to subtract this thing as well. So these guys cancel out. And if this is zero, then this is zero as well. But we assumed that nothing depends on this collective coordinate A. So therefore, this is a correct assumption. And so we've got something that's well defined. So it turns out that if you take this recipe and you do the math, which is simple enough, for the domain wall, you get precisely the simple answers that one gets, and there are no problems with gauge invariance or anything, right? Because this is a gauge invariant quantity to begin with. You can also do this for other magnetic solitons. For instance, if you have a vortex in a two-dimensional ferromagnet, then it has two collective coordinates, x and y, associated with the Broca translational symmetries. And the momentum for x would be proportional to y, the momentum for y would be proportional to x. So you cannot measure these two coordinates simultaneously, right? You don't know exactly where the core is. There will be quantum fluctuations that affect that. So this is my recent paper, basically. Thank you. What is the answer? 42. So this is the expression. All these quantities you can calculate.
And take the simple model where,
right. So for this simple model, you get precisely what one assumed from the beginning. So PZ turns out to be plus 2 spin density times the angle. And P phi turns out to be minus 2j times z. So these are the conserved quantities.
And the ambiguity in the space angle is translated to the ambiguity in
the angle. So if you remember that this comes from a discrete chain, then with discrete translations, there is no problem. Next. It's a non-topological soliton, and then everything is, unless you have a very inconvenient gauge, it usually works out. But actually, let me add something. So in fact, if you use the old recipe, as I mentioned, for the domain wall, you sometimes get right answers for one of the quantities, but not the other. Yeah, you can do that. And in that case, you avoid the south pole, right? Because your magnetization never reaches the south pole because there's a finite distance between your solitons. You almost go down to the south pole, but then you avoid it, and then you come back. And so then in that configuration, there is no problem. Well, you will have the answer for the difference of the angular or the sum of the angular momenta in that case. But for the individual solitons, one can show actually that the canonical momenta, which are computed using the usual prescription, will give you an answer that is never going to coincide fully with the correct answers. So one can basically take the following. Right, so we know that Pi is, or Pa for conserved ones, this is A sub A. And so if you calculate, for instance, the following curl, you will get exactly FAB, which is a quantity that's gauge invariant. But if you take that prescription, so PA is integral F AI DQI, and then you calculate a similar difference, DPA DQB minus DPB DQA, that difference turns out to be twice FAB. So if these quantities are non-zero, and they're non-zero, for a domain wall, if you have an angular coordinate and a linear coordinate, this quantity is 2j. Right? And so it turns out that you can maybe at best get one of these quantities right. This will coincide with that. But then this will not coincide with this because these results will be different. So you can never actually trust fully the standard answer that you get from applying field theory. Yeah, I'll have to think about that. Something will still be wrong. All the answers will not be right. Some of the answers may be right, but not all of them. It's like the ambiguity of momentum of an electron moving in the lattice, right? Both come from the same discreteness of the lattice. Right? So momentum in the lattice is defined modulo 2 pi over A. And
so I think of Polnov in that case, which is kind of closer to magnets. So there, the crystal momentum is only dwelt on up to some number, right? Which just comes from the fact that the crystal itself actually is not perfect translation on that.
Yeah.
real physical momentum carried by the crystal is not carried by quantum, and has
nothing to do with the system. Yeah, but that's that. You know, that's not the conserved quantities we're talking about, right?
Then let's thank you all again.
Thank you.